Cause like a winter tonight, I thought I would always have light. The quick flash that you gave to me, so dark I could barely see.
Welcome everyone, thank you for joining us. We have a great show for you. Today we're going to explore how the early Christians viewed Jesus Christ, as well as how did Jesus become God. So today we have with us Professor Larry Hurtado. Professor Larry Hurtado is the Emeritus Professor of New Testament Language, Literature, and Theology at the School of Divinity in University of Edinburgh. Welcome to the Circle, Professor Hurtado.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So there's a lot of different churches and sects today that looked at Jesus differently. But this also happened, we found out, in the early days as well. So we wanted to explore in today's show is how did the early Christians view Jesus?
Well, from the beginnings of things, I suppose, that are really significant is after Jesus' execution. He is executed by the Roman authorities, probably as a Messiah claimant, as somebody who was thought to be claiming to be king, Jewish king, and therefore a threat to the Romans. So he was executed. And therefore, at that point, it's a failed messianic movement, and he's a failure. Very shortly thereafter, the conviction erupts quite suddenly and quite powerfully that God has raised him from the dead and exalted him to heavenly status, heavenly glory, unique kind of glory. The phrase they use often is, he's at God's right hand, which is sort of a pictographic way of saying, you know, second only to God, God's wazir, his right-hand man, so to speak, and given him the title of Lord and made him sort of the Prince of Salvation for all of the world. This conviction, as I say, seems to have just exploded very quickly and very early in the aftermath of Jesus' execution. From this fundamental conviction that God has exalted him to heavenly glory and given him this kind of unique status and requires now that this be acknowledged, pretty much everything else follows. So that's the initial fundamental conviction. It's fundamentally a conviction or a claim about what God has done as much as it is about Jesus. God has raised him. God has put him at the right hand. And they mean the ancestral God of Israel, the God of the biblical teachings and of, because all of these people are Jews in the first instance. So they believe that their ancestral God, the God of their ancestral people, has vindicated Jesus over against the charges of being a false Messiah, has in fact affirmed him to be true Messiah and Lord, put him at the right hand, at his right hand in heavenly glory, and now requires that be acknowledged. Jesus becomes then, in other words, God's new deal, his new act, the new status by which everything else is to be understood.
I'll ask you one quick question. Do you believe that, I don't want to read into people's minds, but before Jesus actually was crucified, was there apprehension for them to believe that he was the Messiah?
I think there's apprehension that he is claiming to be, or that his followers are making him out to be a Messiah. Scholars debate, you know, New Testament scholars, Jesus scholars debate a lot. We're probably the most critical people in the world, and collectively. And there's a great deal of debate and discussion and caution, hesitancy about what you can or cannot ascribe to the historical figure of Jesus, because we don't have any writings directly from him. We have only reports about what he said and taught, written by his followers and written some few decades to several decades after his execution. So quite rightly, people say, well, gee, what can we do with all this? Very hard to get into the mind of even a contemporary, let alone an ancient person. What I think it is safer to say is that the fact that Jesus was crucified, and that is accepted as a established fact by virtually all historical scholars working in the field, the fact that he was crucified by the Roman authorities most likely means that they took him to be claiming or positing himself as the true royal Messiah. Messiah is typically understood as a royal figure, kind of an heir of King David of the Old Testament, the rightful king of the Jews. So Messiah and king kind of bleed off into each other. So the fact that he was crucified suggest that he was found guilty of sedition, sedition against the Roman imperial rule, and therefore died, was executed as a messianic claimant. Whatever Jesus intended, we can't get into somebody's mind, but that seems to be the way his enemies perceived him, those who took action against him. They perceived that he was making this kind of dangerous, even seditious claim.
Interesting. Now, I know there's another debate among the scholars about when did Jesus become divine? Some say it was early on when he was a human on earth. Some say it was after he got crucified. Any insight on that?
I think it's very rare. It would be a very small minority. I can think of one or two people who've made the claim that Jesus may have thought of himself as divine in some real robust sense of the word during his own earthly ministry. Overwhelmingly, that's seen as not credible for various reasons. So there's no explicit indication of that in the Gospels themselves, and would be it would certainly to report on the sociology of knowledge. Overwhelmingly, it would be very rare to find any scholar who would say that. Virtually all scholars would say any treatment of Jesus as a divine figure in some sense of the word has to be placed in the aftermath of his crucifixion and in the immediate aftermath and consequence of this belief that God has raised him from the dead and exalted him to kind of divine heavenly glory. Now, the question then becomes, when you say, when did Jesus become divine, what do you mean by that? Because in the Roman world, there were oodles of gods, oodles of demigods, oodles of semigods, all sorts. Divinity was sort of a whole series of gradations. The Jewish context of the time, for Jews of the time also, the heavens were rather thickly populated with heavenly beings, not only the one God of Israel, but also oodles of, what we might call angelic beings, other heavenly beings, which are in some sense, heavenly, divine, quasi-divine in some sense of the word. For Jews, the crucial difference among all these beings, the crucial difference between the God of Israel, their one God, and all these other beings, was that only the one God of Israel was to be given worship. He was the only one to whom, for example, sacrifices were offered in the Jerusalem temple. Unlike the Roman temples, which often had multiple deities, multiple images, and so on, in the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, there's only one God worshipped. No image, by the way, but only that one God worshipped, none of the other creatures. And we have very strong strictures in ancient Jewish texts making that clear, that none of the angels, none of the other gods of the other peoples or whatever are to receive worship. There may be something to them. They don't necessarily deny their existence, but they're utterly unworthy of worship. So when we say Jesus became divine, we have to ask, what do we mean? The point that I've made along with some other people for the last 25, 30 years or so is that the most spectacular development in early Christianity is evidence that Jesus very quickly came to receive what we may call a kind of worship along with the one God of Israel, and that this seems to have originated among groups of people who were devout, sort of God-fearing Jews. That is, not amongst pagans who would have been more open to multiple deities, but among people whose whole ancestral tradition drew a very sharp line between the one God and all other beings. And as far as their devotional practice is concerned, at a very early point, these Jewish followers of Jesus begin to put Jesus, so to speak, on the God side of the line when it comes to their devotional practice. They appeal to him. They invoke him at their meetings in order to constitute their worship gatherings. The entrance rite that they perform, baptism, is done in the name of Jesus, for which we have no parallel in Jewish tradition of the time. Their sacred corporate meal that they have together, they portray as a meal in honor of Jesus, in remembrance of him, and in some sense, at least in some circles, with Jesus understood as sort of mystically or spiritually present, like a cult deity in the Roman meals of the time. They perform exorcisms and healings in his name. They invoke him jointly in prayer with God. So he's functioning, you might say, in their devotional practice in a way that seems uniquely to associate him with God, in ways in which Jews felt forbidden to treat any of these other figures. That, it seems to me, is the really crucial development. from there, of course, you then have a long history of Christian reflection, doctrinal reflection, particularly over the first three or four centuries, in which Christians begin to continue to sort of ponder out, well, what does this mean? What are the logical, theological, philosophical implications of this? But the point is, before they had all of this worked out, they felt impelled very early to accord Jesus this kind of devotional attention, this kind of devotional honor, and then spent the next few centuries sort of figuring out how to put that all together, how to rationalize that, you might say, in a body of doctrine and teaching. And those controversies go on well into the fourth century.
The actual Gospels weren't put together. When were they all put together for the first time?
Well, the individual Gospels that we have in the New Testament are commonly thought to be the earliest examples of that literary genre. And they're commonly thought to have begun being written down in that form somewhere around 70 AD, which would be about 40 years or so after Jesus' execution. The earliest of them is commonly thought to be the Gospel of Mark. And then the other three Gospels come along within, say, a decade or two thereafter. So sometime between 70 to roughly 90 AD, these four Gospels are probably composed.
Hi, welcome to Adelante. This is Adelante Recovery, and my name is Yvette Kuglin, and I'm part of the staff.
Adelante Recovery Center has helped people in dual diagnosis for 5 years. We accept most PPO insurances and provide luxury accommodations and 24-hour support. To speak with an admissions counselor, call 1-888-242-4450.
A lot of time, we don't even know what's wrong with us, and sometimes we need to get away to figure that out. So if you want to go for a little retreat out in Corona del Mar, which is a confidential location, we're here to help. So we're only a phone call away. Thank you.
What is the common consensus of why it took them so long to write it? Were they afraid of their lives? Was the oral tradition more prevalent?
Well, they have to distinguish between what scholars often refer to as Jesus traditions and the literary gospels. We know that traditions about Jesus, his sayings, references to his death and resurrection, reference to a number of his teachings, as you say, were being circulated and being used already in our earliest Christian writings, which are the letters of the Apostle Paul, written somewhere between roughly 50 to 60 AD. Already there, you see the author referring in passing often to sayings of Jesus, to the example of Jesus, to the teachings of Jesus. So Jesus is all the talk, you might say, of these early Jewish Christian circles from the get-go, it seems, and references to his death and resurrection and teachings. What we have in the Gospels, and in particular the first one, the Gospel of Mark, is rather not so much a kind of major step change in suddenly talking about Jesus. They've been talking about Jesus all along. What we have in the case of the Gospel of Mark is a new literary production in which traditions about Jesus, his sayings, some of his actions, reports of his miracles and all that sort of thing, names of his disciples, all of this body of information that's been circulating around in a more ad hoc basis is put together in a continuous narrative account of Jesus' life. Scholars are increasingly, I think, recognizing, the Gospel of Mark is kind of the earliest Christian appropriation of the kind of Roman biographical genre, biography or bios-type literature, as one scholar has called it, is emerging first in the Hellenistic and Roman period. It's a kind of new literary genre, and the earliest examples of it go back to the sort of late Hellenistic and Roman period. It's still fluid, it's still flexible. And the Gospel of Mark, I think, as many scholars would say, is the initial Christian appropriation and adaptation of this bios-type genre for the purposes of giving a written account, a kind of consecutive, ordered narrative account of the life and ministry of Jesus.
Let me ask you,
the reason for that, why did they do that? Well, various suggestions have been given. One is that it's not by accident that it's 40 years later. that one of the factors is that the initial followers of Jesus, the apostles and those who were able to sort of talk about his life and ministry on a firsthand basis, were dying off, in some cases being killed off, as in the case of Peter, probably, who was martyred sometime under Nero, we think, in the 60s. So people were dying off, being killed off, is one reason. However, it's also clear that there was more to it than just that. I mean, in the case of the Gospel of Mark, a fair case can be made that the author had much more specific reasons for writing this book about Jesus, one of them being to present Jesus as a kind of role model for believers, for Christians. And so he emphasizes a story that, interestingly note, begins with Jesus' baptism, extends into his preaching and sort of ministry activity, relates how he gets opposition, how he's tried and executed, and then at the end the divine promise is, but he has been raised. That, as a number of scholars have pointed out, is kind of the shape of early Christian existence. You know, it begins with baptism, it issues into a life of activity and so on, and in the early Roman setting, Christians were frequently warned, prepare yourself for persecution, for opposition, perhaps even for execution, and if you do so, you know, man up, take it, and trust in God's ultimate vindication of you by resurrection. So this story is not only it fits into the general kind of genre of bios type literature, but it seems to have quite a specific, you might say, pastoral purpose to it as well. Presenting Jesus as a role model, not only a foundation, but a role model for disciples, and basically saying, hang in there, take up your cross, to cite Mark, take up your cross and follow Jesus, and you may have to suffer like he did, but you can count on the same kind of vindication that he received as well.
Let me ask you a quick question here. The different Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke specifically, and John, seem to portray Jesus in different ways, or at least try to give a different representation of Jesus. Paul also seems to be giving a different representation of Jesus. Is this as distinctive as a difference between, a Baptist and an Anglican? Are they that diverse, or are they just different personality portraits of Jesus?
Well, I suppose that we're talking about rough analogies, but I guess the rough analogy of maybe different denominations might not be totally out of line. You know, Baptist, Methodist, Anglican, whatever. Particularly because, these different denominations as we know them sort of each kind of emphasizes, well, we think we've got some cool points, you know, that you don't have. Nevertheless, they all, many of these at least, you know, respect one another and reflect, yeah, okay, you aren't a Methodist, but you're a Christian anyway. Or you aren't really a Baptist, but nevertheless, we'll treat you as a brother anyway. So if you think of it that way, yes, we do have different kinds of emphases, different kinds of Christians. Pauline Christianity is one kind. The Judean Christianity of Aramaic-speaking, Semitic-speaking Jews in Roman Judea is another. They have different emphases. In some cases, very sharp disagreements with each other, but are not necessarily considering each other as apostates or absolute heretics. In some cases, there are those kind of conflicts, though. The letters of Paul, as I say, are our earliest Christian texts, which take us back into the 50s. And in these letters, it's quite clear that there are some very sharp differences among some Christians. Paul refers to certain other Jewish Christians. He himself is a Jewish Christian, but he refers to some other Jewish Christians as false brothers, false apostles. Very, very negative terms. And so it's quite clear that there were sharp differences, people who absolutely disagreed with each other on things that were quite crucial. In other cases, relatively minor differences of emphasis. Now, among the four Gospels, it doesn't look to me or to most scholars that Matthew wrote because he considered Mark a heretic, or that Luke wrote because he considered Mark a heretic, if Mark was the first one, as most of us think, and these others came later. Actually, it's interesting, Matthew, we'll call him Matthew, all of these Gospels are anonymous, but they're traditional names. Matthew, the author of whoever the author was of Matthew, if you do analysis of it, he's incorporated into his gospel about 90% of the Gospel of Mark, plus adding on some additional material, his birth story, resurrection appearances, a large new body of additional sayings of Jesus. So it looks as though what you have in the Gospel of Matthew, in some sense, is, structurally speaking, a kind of souped-up version of the Gospel of Mark, you know? A gospel that has extended its narrative line and is beefed up enormously with the amount of teaching material, and seems particularly intended for that purpose, seems intended to serve much more as a kind of teaching resource for Christianity, pushing his particular point of view.
Do you think there's a reason for that?
Well, I think that it looks to us, most of us, that the authors of Matthew and Luke certainly saw Mark as a kind of inspirational example, kind of model, saying, hey, that's a great idea. Only I think I could do something a little better or a little fuller or more adequate or more appropriate perhaps for particular purposes. So the Gospel of Luke, for example, seems to have been written, addressed to a certain Theophilus in the opening words. And that guy may be a real name of a guy, in which case he's somebody who seems to be a convert, and he's a representative figure of probably a pagan or former pagan, a Gentile, as Jews would say, a non-Jewish person, who has come to this religion. And the author says, I want to instruct you in it. I want to give you reasons for believing what you've been taught. So he kind of gives a full defense and explanation of Jesus, presenting the figure of Jesus a little more as a kind of heroic figure, in ways that sound a bit more like kind of the idea of a Roman era heroic figure. Whereas Matthew presents him much more as a kind of rabbinic figure, kind of early Jewish rabbi who when he talks very much in cadences that sound very Jewish. And Mark is a little more bare bones kind of thing, as I say. Wasn't primarily interested in conveying a whole body of teaching, because he doesn't, but instead interested in presenting Jesus as a kind of exemplary figure for followers. So part of the differences among them is they have these different purposes. Another analogy you could use would be the different ways that sermons from week to week, or sermons by different preachers, even on the same text, if you ever darken the doors of church very frequently, you'll know that you could sometimes hear the same text preached on a different occasion by different preachers, and they will put a different spin on it, make a different emphasis out of it. And, that seems to be what they're doing with the figure of Jesus. I've used the musical analogy in a book that I wrote once, in which the Gospels, I've said, can be thought of in some sense as like musical renditions of a common score. You have a classical piece of music, but you have different conductors, different orchestras that will arrange the piece differently, that will play it at a different pace, that may interpret the piece musically in different ways. Or to pick another example, you can take a fairly common, straightforward show tune piece or crooner piece, give it to a jazz musician or a jazz combo, you'll recognize the basic melody line, but there's something very different going on with it in terms of arrangement. And so that's the sort of analogy that I've used. The four Gospels can be thought of as kind of textual versions, different textual renditions, so to speak. And I use that in the musical sense of the word, not in the CIA sense of the word. Different renditions of Jesus musically.
Now, let's not bring them into this. Quick question for you. I want to try to have you condense your 30 years of experience here in about 5 minutes. Another miracle. But what do you think about the Greek culture influence, such as the views that they had about Jesus? I think Origen was influenced by the Greeks.
Yes, we know that influence, Greek influence, is there from the beginning. I mean, the fact that all of the New Testament writings are written in Greek certainly shows a linguistic influence, with Greek becoming the common trade language, the international language, the sort of the English of the day, if I could put it that way. And so these texts are written clearly to be trans-ethnic, trans-local texts. Paul's letters and all the other writings of the New Testament, most of us think, were originally written in Greek. So strong linguistic influence. They also reflect, to come back to the Gospels again, if, as most of us think, the Gospel texts reflect the influence of the Roman era bios genre, biographical genre, then there's another kind of literary influence shaping somewhat the way in which they package or present Jesus in literary forms. We also know from these writers, that from the vocabulary that they use, that a number of terms, number of concepts that stem from Greek philosophical tradition. For example, Paul refers to the human conscience. Well, that word conscience comes from Greek philosophy. There isn't really an equivalent word in ancient Hebrew or in the Jewish background. So certain concepts, certain categories are there from the beginning. As you move into the second century, with figures such as Justin of Rome, Justin Martyr, or Irenaeus, or Origen, as you mentioned, here you have people who have studied Greek philosophy and who are deliberately trying to engage that intellectual world, trying to present, articulate, and defend Christian faith in that larger intellectual environment. So they're quite deliberately taking on board the categories, concepts of their intellectual climate precisely in order to make inroads into it, precisely in order to persuade such people of the truth of their religion. It's not accidental. They're not being unconsciously influenced by it. They are grabbing, you might say, the intellectual and the philosophical culture of their time with both hands and using it as a way of trying to communicate back to the larger culture. Quite a bold and even, you would say, audacious kind of stance.
Very fascinating. That was wonderful insight. I wish we had more time. Professor Hurtado, if people want to learn more about the New Testament, want to get your books or contact you, how do they do that?
Well, I suppose you could go into Amazon and just type my name in, and it will bring up books, or go to my I also have a blog site where I try to write ever so often, particularly for a kind of wider general public. It's simply, if they Google in simply, it's called Larry Hurtado's blog.
Larry Hurtado's blog.
And so if you just Google, or even just Google my name, it'll probably bring up that link.
That's Larry Hurtado, Hurtado. Once again, thank you so much, Professor, for that great insight. We can see how complex it really is to get a picture of Jesus. There are a lot of moving parts here.
Well, you can see why scholars have devoted sometimes 25 or 35 years to the public, to the subject. It's not that we're stupid. It's a very fascinating but also very complex question.
Very much. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did. Remember, our motto is simple. Wherever there's psychology involved, we are there. We'll see you next time, everyone.